Oye, oye. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you will be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable.
Well, good morning. I'm Chief Judge Allen, and to my right is Judge Toth. To my left is Judge Lauer. And we're convened this morning to consider arguments in the matter of Cassidy A. Perkins versus Douglas A. Collins, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 24-6515. And would counsel, beginning with the appellant's counsel, state your appearance for the record, please.
Please the court. I'm Lauren Hancock Miller, and I'm joined here by David DiPeppo and Timothy McHugh.
Thank you very much. Secretary's counsel.
Good morning. My name is Kirsten Dowell on behalf of the Secretary, and with me is Deputy Chief Counsel Sarah Fusina.
Nice to see you both. And I understand that you're going to be reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that right? All right. Then you can begin when you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is Lauren Hancock Miller, and I, along with my team, represent Cassidy Perkins, petitioner in this matter. Your Honors, roughly a year ago, the Supreme Court made clear that veterans who separately accrue benefits under both the Montgomery and post 9/11 GI bills are entitled to use both benefits in any order they choose up to the statutory cap. Nonetheless, rather than apply the Supreme Court's clear reasoning, the VA looks for every attempt to distinguish Rudisill, eventually relying on 3322H1. But that reliance is misplaced, and this court should reverse the board's decision for two main reasons. First, Rudisill v. McDonough makes clear that Ms. Cassidy Perkins is separately entitled to Montgomery and post 9/11 benefits based on her sufficiently lengthy 6 years of service. And second, the VA's reliance on 38 U.S.C. 3322H is based on a misinterpretation of a heading, as that interpretation is not rooted in the statutory text, is not supported by Rudisill v. McDonough, and leads to inconsistent results. The better interpretation of period of service is that period necessary to qualify an individual for entitlement to education benefits. Starting with my first point, the Supreme Court's discussion of the statutory scheme in Rudisill v. McDonough leads to the conclusion that Ms. Cassidy Perkins is entitled to both Montgomery and post 9/11 benefits.
So let me ask you, what's the difference in terms of how they function between, I guess, the Section A and subsection H for 3322? So what subsection A do and what does subsection H do?
Subsection A ensures that an individual cannot receive both benefits at the same time. So subsection A is going to ensure that during one semester, the veteran is choosing to either use Montgomery or post 9/11 benefits. Subsection H is ensuring that an individual who served only one qualifying period, so for example, for 36 months, that individual is not going to receive both the full Montgomery and the full post 9/11 benefits.
So the function of subsection H then would be you can't kind of stack entitle. You'd have to stack position. You could, with 36 months of, or assuming you satisfied the whatever the eligibility requirements of each discreetly, you could only then use one. Presumably people would use the 9/11 one because that's better. And then I guess the idea would be if you want to earn, after having elected 9/11, if you want to earn the Montgomery, you would have to satisfy the full duration of that period. Is that how you read that?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think this is supported by the legislative history that this court cited in footnote 9 of BO v. Wilkie. And in that footnote, it explains that Congress had originally enacted 3322H in order to prevent veterans who only served, for example, 36 months from receiving the full entitlement to both benefits, because between 2008 and 2011, that is how the VA was enacting the statutory scheme. They were allowing individuals to, as this court put it and as the Supreme Court put it, double dip. And so in order to prevent that situation, Congress enacted 3322H to make clear that you must, if you only have one qualifying period of service, you have to choose which Montgomery or post 9/11 benefit you'd like to receive.
And so this is a grossly simplistic way to put it, but is your position basically this, which is Ms. Cassidy has 6 years of service, and in order to obtain the 9/11 benefit, she hypothetically uses years 1, 2, and 3. And so we take those years off and we put them to the side. And then to, she's got 3 unused years left. And for the Montgomery GI Bill, she uses years 5 and 6, right? She's actually got 1 left over, right? And so because she doesn't have to use any single year twice, your position, as I understood it from the briefing, is that H never comes into play because it's not the situation where you have only years 1, 2, and 3, and in order to get 1 benefit, you use 1, 2, 3, and to get the other one, you'd have to use 1 and 2, and so you'd be double counting. Is that sort of a grossly simplistic way of thinking about this?
Yes, Your Honor. Exactly. We're saying that because Ms. Perkins doesn't even have to count a single day twice, she is not double dipping. And we believe this is supported by Ruta Silva McDonough, because if you look at the Supreme Court's discussion, in addition to going out of its way and 3 times making clear that it was looking at length of service, it also explained that the entire purpose of 3322 is to, quote, prevent double dipping. And as this court put it when in BO v. Wilkie, if there is no duplication, there's no cause for concern. That was the entire purpose of 3322H. And under our interpretation of this statute or of this provision, there would be no double dipping. And the Supreme Court at Penn site 309 explained that 3322H was only meant to further 3322's goal, which further ensures that an individual may not receive double credit for a single period of service. In explaining and summarizing all of 3322, the Supreme Court said, quote, per 3322, service members who are eligible for education benefits under either Montgomery or post 9/11 from a period of service that could qualify for either program can opt to credit that service toward one education benefits program or the other. Then immediately after that, the court contrasted this situation and said, if service members serve for long enough, they may be entitled to both, referring to Montgomery and post 9/11 benefits. So in discussing 3322, the Supreme Court was making clear that this situation would be allowed. You could earn both benefits based on the length of your military service.
When Ms. Perkins enlisted, what was the term of her enlistment contract, if you know?
It was 6 years, Your Honor.
6-year enlistment contract. Okay. And at the time, post 9/11 GI Bill was effective.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so presumably, Ms. Perkins made a conscious decision to pay into the Montgomery GI Bill, which required, unlike the post 9/11, a payment.
Right.
Okay. And then also was aware that there was the post 9/11 GI Bill benefit that was out there.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that the way the Montgomery benefit statute works supports this provision, this understanding as well, because under the Montgomery statute, once you earn your 36 months, once you have done the 36 months of qualifying service, it goes on to say in 3011B that an individual can continue on active duty, the individual can be discharged, the individual can be released on after service on active duty, the individual can go into the reserve. Congress wasn't concerned with what happened after the 36 months. And in fact, an individual can start receiving Montgomery benefits once those 36 months are finished, and while they're still serving, be obtaining those benefits. So clearly Congress only meant to ensure that the individual had that qualifying period, and then they became entitled. And once an individual is entitled to benefits, the VA shall pay those benefits unless there's some reason to prevent that, like the statutory cap, the 48-month statutory cap, or 3322A, which ensures that you cannot use them at the same time. Other than those two bars, an individual who has earned entitlement gets their entitlement, and the VA has to pay that. And applying Rudisil, the answer here is clear. Ms. Perkins is entitled to 48 months of a combination of benefits. Based on her first 3 periods, as you noted, Chief Judge Allen, she would get Montgomery benefits. Based on the second 3 years, she would get 36 months of post 9/11 benefits. And not a single day is double counted.
Could I jump in here? And this is definitely going to be an inarticulate question. I rarely can make a promise I know I'm going to keep, but this one I can. Well, I don't entirely follow this, and so, Ms. Dowell, be prepared, because I'm going to ask you something similar. The Secretary, at some points in his briefing, makes a big deal about a distinction with Rudisill in the sense that Mr. Rudisill's years of service occurred in the period before subsection H was the effective date, while Ms. Perkins was after. That's descriptively correct, I think. But, and while I don't understand the Secretary's position, can you respond to it? That's the inarticulate part of my question.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that the effective date is a distraction. The effective date, like the rest of the statute, 3322H applies to the individual who is applying for benefits at that moment. From the day it was enacted beyond, 3322H was applying. And I believe that's the way this court understood and the Supreme Court understood that provision to work. For example, when this case came before BO v. Wilkie, the VA was making that same argument, was espousing that and saying that 3322H was only effective after 2011. Yet this court still considered 3322H's effect on the entire scheme. And actually, Your Honor, at 335, you said this court, or 3322H was one of the most important subsections to its decision. Clearly, this court and the Supreme Court wanted to know how 3322H applied to the entire statutory scheme, and were considering that in figuring out how the entire statutory scheme applied to Mr. Rudisill.
And so is it fair then to say that from the appellant's perspective here, the key to the effectiveness of the effective date of H is that if you were somebody who was applying for benefits before that date, H would not apply. Well, if you applied after, it would. Again, saying nothing about the factual circumstances being one that are relevant to H or not, and that the time at which you served is irrelevant for purposes of H.
Yes, Your Honor. 3322H could not have been relevant if you applied before because it wasn't in effect yet. However, as soon as it became in effect, just like the rest of the statute, for example, 3327 explicitly references a 2009 date, but no one doubts that 3327 applied to anyone applying for benefits at that time and not to service that happened after 2009. The entire statute was meant to apply to individuals as they were now asking for benefits, and it applied to them at that moment. And beyond that, Your Honor, I'd like to also make clear that 3322H simply isn't applicable here, so its effective date is irrelevant. The more pertinent aspect of this is that 3322H simply does not apply. And this brings me to my second point, which is that the VA's decision rests on an erroneous interpretation of 3322H1's heading. The VA contends that period of service is determined by an individual's specific obligation or agreement with the DOD. But there's nothing in the statutory text that supports that position. As an initial matter, I'd like to just note that a heading cannot rewrite a statute, although headings can, of course, help this court understand what Congress was trying to do. It can't rewrite the statutory text. And if you look at the statutory text, it states, an individual with qualifying service in the armed forces that establishes eligibility on the part of such individual for educational assistance under this chapter, various chapters, shall elect in such form and manner as the Secretary may prescribe under which authority such service is to be credited. So the key language here is with qualifying service that establishes eligibility. Clearly, Congress was looking at that amount of time that was necessary for an individual to qualify for eligibility, and they were not looking to any sort of agreement or any obligated period. They were simply looking at whether or not the individual qualified. That's consistent with, as we discussed previously, Congress's intent in enacting this provision, as this court noted in footnote 9, and it's consistent with the Supreme Court's understanding, which was to prevent, quote, double dipping. Beyond that, the VA's position doesn't fully comport with the statutory scheme and the way post-9/11 benefits are given to individuals. Individuals are given post-9/11 benefits for even small periods of service, for coming on into service for 90 days from the reserves. I mean, this was meant to help individuals receive benefits for wartime, and Congress was asking people to come out of the reserves for short stints, for 90 days, for 6 months. And Congress, through its provisions in the post-9/11 GI Bill, was allowing those individuals to receive post-9/11 benefits. And even though the individual would then go back into the reserves or however it would be and would have separate periods, that individual may not become entitled to the full amount of benefits.
And so is that, I know that the term, right, period of service is in the heading, right? And so your argument is it really shouldn't be read into the statutory language, but let's assume, well, how would you define it then if you had to define the periods of service?
It would be that period necessary to qualify an individual for entitlement to benefits. So it could, this court actually referred to it multiple times in BOV Wilkie as a qualifying period of service. You'll see in the Montgomery Benefit Statute, for example, at 3011F, Congress uses period of service multiple times. The period of service has always been an easy shorthand for individuals, and it is easy to use. But Congress says things like periods of active duty, periods of continuous service. Period just means length. So period of service is just meant to show a time that the Congress was looking at. In this case, it then told us in the statutory text that that period or length of time it's looking at is the time necessary to qualify an individual for service. And beyond that, Your Honors, the VA's interpretation, beyond not having any support in the statutory scheme and it's being inconsistent with Rudisill, it also leads to inconsistent results. So individuals who serve shorter periods of time can receive more benefits simply because at the outset, they didn't choose to serve their country for a longer period. So an individual who, for example, decides to only serve their country for 3 years, for example, and then quickly reenlist for 2 years, that individual is going to get the full amount of benefits simply because they didn't agree at the outset that they wanted to serve for that five-year time. There's nothing in the statute that indicates that Congress meant to reward coming back to the service or reenlisting over simply choosing to serve their country at the beginning. So if there are no further questions, Your Honor.
I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
So after the Supreme Court issued its decision in Rudisill, the VA put out some guidance to help veterans decide whether or not they're eligible for various GI Bill benefits. And the website defined, and this is at issue here, they actually use the term separate periods of service as including, quote, two periods of service connected via reenlistment. And this was a little bit of back and forth in the briefing, right, because the secretary took umbrage about requiring a break in service, which was the term that was used in the opening brief. Have you found anything that's consistent with the government's interpretation of what's required under H here to define period of service?
Anything consistent with?
Consistent with the government's view.
Your Honor, no. There's nothing that I can find that would suggest that reenlistments or anything of that sort is necessary to receive both benefits. And I'll also note, Your Honor, and I apologize that we were not able to give you this case. It just came out in the last week and became public. But at 2025-WL-739-219, the VA recently denied benefits to an individual who served for 26 years, and that individual had two DD forms 214. And the VA expressly said that that person, quote, had a single period of service. So it's been a little bit difficult to fully lock down what the VA's position is, as it seems to just be a bit of post hoc litigation strategy. The VA isn't consistently necessarily applying this. So to the extent they are not requiring a break in service, there are other cases that suggest that they are.
And that was what you just said. Was that a board decision?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
It's maybe a trivial question, but I'm curious. Why does Perkins use the Montgomery benefits first?
Perkins actually used the post 9/11 benefits.
Oh.
So she did use the post 9/11 benefits. She has about 4 months of those left. And then, 4 months under the 36-month cap that she's been given. Should the court disagree with the board's decision, as we suggest, she will get another 12 months, which will then be Montgomery benefits.
Okay. So she did. I misread that. She has not used the Montgomery?
Not yet.
Okay.
I'm just curious, a hypothetical. So under the secretary's interpretation of the period, how would that work for officers?
Your Honor, that's a great point. As far as we know, and we have a different client that is in that position, and officers are commissioned by the president. So they don't get these reenlistments. They don't get to have these separate periods of service. And as what we've seen from the VA doing, they are treating that as a single period of service. So officers who serve their country for 24 years are considered to have a single period of service simply because they don't have the option to reenlist.
Would it make a difference if there were periods of obligated service? In other words, and I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but oftentimes there are bonuses or other reasons to go beyond your original obligated service, which can vary depending on for commissioned officers. But would that make a difference if there were?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the statutory scheme that suggests that Congress wanted to replace other sort of incentives or have those other incentives replace the Montgomery benefits or the post 9/11 benefits. These benefits are meant to also help individuals readjust to civilian life upon their return. They're supposed to reward those individuals for their long service. So there's no reason that Congress couldn't have allowed veterans to receive, especially veterans who have served their country for decades and who have been officers in this military, from receiving both benefits.
So appellant's view is just the length of time and whether or not it is sufficient to qualify for entitlement, regardless of reenlisting, regardless of additional obligated service. Is that a fair?
Yes, Your Honor. Because Congress used qualifying service and did not use contractual service, obligated service, any other term, but used qualifying service and then pointed judges and the VA to the particular qualifying statutes like the Montgomery Bill and 3011, 3311, post 9/11. It was telling everyone reading it to look to those statutes and see how an individual qualifies for the benefits. If you look here, Ms. Perkins qualifies for both. Without double counting, we believe that Congress intended that an individual who earned the benefits that Congress provided them and met all of the qualifications should be able to receive both benefits, and that there is no material difference between an individual who chose at the beginning to serve 6 years as opposed to someone who later on decided that they would serve an additional 3 years. We believe both individuals should get benefits. We just don't think the former should be precluded from receiving those benefits simply because they at the outset chose to serve their country longer.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions.
Thank you very much, Ms.
Yes, the court reverses.
Ms. Dowell, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. The court should affirm the board's decision because the controlling statutory section 38 U.S.C. 3322H1 bars appellant from using her single period of service to receive Chapter 30 benefits in addition to Chapter 33 educational assistance benefits.
I hate to jump in right at the beginning, but here's a question. It's a hypothetical. Okay, so Ms. Perkins served from 2014 to 2020. I think I got that right. Okay. Let's just assume everything else in the case is the same. Everything except her period of service was from 2004 to 2010. Is the VA's position the same, that she's not entitled to be able to use the two benefits up to a 48-month cap?
Your Honor, the VA's position would be different if her period of service were prior to August 1st, 2011.
So then this idea about a break in service is not important to you. So in other words, hypothetical number two, her period of service is from 2014 to 2017. She then takes a month off and reenlists for 2017 to 2020. So it's the same 2004 to 2020, 2014 to 2020, but there's a 1 month break. Is the VA's position that she is not entitled to benefits?
No, Your Honor, because she would have two separate periods of service at that point.
So why does that make any sense?
Because VA, Your Honor, used to pay veterans for a single period of service, both Montgomery and post 9/11 benefits. Congress was aware that VA was doing that, and it specifically amended 3322 with H1 to stop VA from doing that.
But why isn't the effective date relevant to when the person is applying for benefits, what as opposed to the years for which the application is relevant? Do you see what I mean? Because VA's answer is that the effective date of H is important with respect to when the service occurred, not necessarily only when you sought the benefit.
Yes, Your Honor. My understanding is that it looks at the date that one entered service as opposed to the date one applied for benefits, because the educational assistance benefits are at least in part recruitment incentives.
So then if the years of service are what matter, not when you apply, meaning H is important for people whose service occurred after the period of time, not tied to just when they applied, what do you do in a situation with my third hypothetical? Assume that Ms. Perkins' service was from 2008 to 2014.
Yes. My understanding, Your Honor, is that she could then be eligible for both Montgomery and post 9/11 benefits because her service did not begin on or after August 1st, 2011. It would have begun in 2008.
Boy, it seems like Congress really made this super complicated as opposed to just saying that H applies when you, with respect to when you apply for benefits, as opposed to thinking about all of these things, right? I mean, I guess I understand the Secretary's position, but what do we do with the fact that from Bruticel itself, that Justice Jackson tells us, interestingly, not only what she's doing in the majority, meaning she's focusing on the length of service, but she then goes on to actually expressly say, and here's what I'm not doing, which is looking at periods of service. She specifically does that. So it's not just the idea that you could say, oh, well, this is what the court relied on, and so by implication, it did not rely on this other thing. She tells us both. And the court mentions H. It would seem to me if the answer was H doesn't apply because Mr. Rudisil's lengthy service was before H being there, that's what the Supreme Court would have said about H, not what it did say. Do you see?
Your Honor, some of the quotes from Rudisil were taken out of context, and I would like to address those quotes in context, if I may.
Okay. Although I do want you to address what I asked you, you can do your no, you can do your bit first. But just the idea that I'm not taking out of context that Justice Jackson said, for the majority, right, that notably, she says, our analysis does not focus on his periods of service. Rather, what matters is that his lengthy service conferred two separate entitlements. Okay, so you can tell me the out-of-context bits, but then I do want you to address that because that tells me something that seems pretty important.
Certainly, Your Honor. Right before that sentence was, so from the outset, we know that Rudisil earned two separate benefit entitlements, one for the Montgomery GI Bill and one for the post 9/11 GI Bill, by serving in the military for nearly 8 years over three separate periods. The sentence following the quotation is that each period of service was of sufficient length to entitle him to educational benefits. So there was no question that he was entitled to two separate educational benefits. And that's why the Supreme Court's analysis did not focus on the periods of service. It was that his lengthy service conferred separate entitlements because they took place over those multiple periods, whereas Ms. Perkins has one period of service, and period of service is critical for understanding her benefit entitlements.
Even though the Supreme Court says our focus is not on his periods of service?
Correct, Your Honor, because for him, his periods of service all took place. He entered service for each of the three periods prior to August 1st, 2011.
So, but other than the Supreme Court saying that as descriptive, can you point me to anything in the Supreme Court's decision that says that that has the legal significance that VA is putting on this? That is, that it was, would have been different somehow if the period was after 2011?
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court does look at 3322H1. It seems to be doing so in the context of understanding the greater statutory scheme of 3322. And it explains, per Section 3322, service members who are eligible for educational benefits under either the Montgomery GI Bill or the post-9/11 GI Bill from a period of service that could qualify for either program opt to credit that service towards one educational benefits program or the other.
So what do we do with the fact that the oddity of the Secretary's position is somebody could serve less time and get more benefits, right? Because it strikes me that I'm not sure why Congress would have created an incentive like that that would make it more difficult for the military, right? In other words, somebody who we assume they have perfect knowledge would never agree to a six-year period of time to serve. Instead, they'd say, nope, I'm going to go three, and then I'm going to leave, even though I think I'm going to want to come back. But then the military would not have the predictability of somebody having a six-year. That doesn't seem like that would be something Congress would incentivize.
Your Honor, when Congress was discussing the amendment to 3322 that became H1, it explained that the law at the time allowed individuals entering active duty to establish both Montgomery and post-9/11 benefits based off of the same period of service. It provided an example in the Senate report of an individual who served for one period of service and would then become entitled to both benefits up to the 48-month aggregate cap. And Congress specifically included, or amended rather, I'm sorry, subsection 3322H1 to prevent VA from continuing to pay those two educational benefits based on one period of service.
Yes, but isn't it important that the Senate report, I think you're talking about report 111-346 at page 19, and so that's my law clerk who got me to there, not me. Isn't it important that the example Congress used was a person who had served 3 years? Because it seems to me that gets to my math sort of question that I asked your friend on the other side, which was what Congress was saying is that person has 3 years. And what they were doing is using 1, 2, 3 to get one benefit and 1, 2 to get a different benefit, and Congress was saying that's double dipping. But if you're in a situation where you can use 1, 2, 3 to get one benefit and 4, 5 to get the second, the concern Congress appeared to be dealing with doesn't exist anymore.
But Your Honor, in 3322H1, Congress specifically referred to a period of service rather than a 3-year period or a 2-year period. And period of service is something Congress uses consistently as a term of art throughout. For example, 38 U.S.C. 5303, certain bars to benefits, explains that certain reasons for discharge or dismissal shall bar rights to benefits based upon the period of service from which discharged or dismissed.
Right. And so your position would be if Ms. Cassidy served from 2014 until 2017, and then left for one day, and then re-enlisted to serve from 2017 to 2020. So her period of service is the length of service is exactly the same other than that one day off. Now she gets up to 48 months, whereas in her current situation, she's capped at 36.
Correct, Your Honor.
Why in the world would we interpret a statute to say that is what's required?
Because the legislative history, the intent of Congress, the heading, the plain meaning of the text itself make clear what VA has to do with the law.
Okay. It seems sort of strange, doesn't it, though? Right, that we'd say that instead of incentivizing an individual to commit for the full 6 years that he or she wants to, and so the military knows they can count on the person for the 6 years, we're going to incentivize them to not do that, to leave the military, to go through all of the separation that you would do, to then re-up. And Congress decided, boy, that's the thing that we need to do, right? That's the VA's position, though.
Yes, Your Honor, VA is bound by Congress's statutes. And
well, it's true, but I mean, listen, many years ago, I sat in this courtroom in that seat, right, a much more comfortable seat, and heard the first case, BO. And I'll tell you, the counsel from the secretary made the same point, right? And then we eventually get up to the Supreme Court that says 7-2 that was entirely wrong. So it just does seem that VA is taking every single opportunity to fight this to the core, asking us to take a scalpel to the Supreme Court decision and make it really these fine cuts. I'll tell you, from being a lower court judge, I don't want to cut Supreme Court cases like that because it's sort of dangerous.
Yes, Your Honor, but Rudisill looked at a different legal question, which was how someone with multiple periods of service that entitle him to more than one benefit can use those benefits.
Even though the court then, when deciding that question, said we're not relying on periods of service, we're relying on his length of service. That's what I keep coming back to.
Right, Your Honor, but it wasn't that Rudisill said that lengthy service alone confers multiple benefits. It was that his periods of service, his separate periods of service, were of sufficient length. Moreover, his periods of service all began prior to August 1st, 2011, which is entirely different factually than Ms. Perkins' single period of service and the date that she entered service.
Okay. I'd like to follow up on a question that is related to what I asked opposing counsel earlier, and that is, so in the government's brief, it acknowledged that Congress has not defined the term period of service, right? And again, after the Supreme Court issued Rudisill, the VA puts out guidance, which when I last looked, which was on March 7th, went on to provide guidance related to what that means, using the term, quote, separate periods of service, as including two periods of service connected via reenlistment. Okay, so the question is, acknowledge Congress hasn't defined, where does that come from? Where does this, and then there's, you know, a little bit of back and forth in the briefing saying, no, it's not a break in service, it could be consecutive enlistments. I think, where, can you point me anywhere directly where that guidance is coming from?
Your Honor, the requirement is the separate periods of service, to make sure I'm understanding your question correctly. The periods of service itself is explicitly used in the heading of 3322H1, but the meaning of a period of service is a term of art that's consistently used not only by Congress, but also by this court. For example, Brown v. Wilkie, 32 Vet App 226, a 2019 case, explained that the question was whether a discharge that triggers a statutory bar to benefits applies to a veteran's entire period of service, and explained that it does. The court rejected the argument that an officer's single period of service could be bifurcated to receive benefits for a period where he was injured, even though an earlier part of his period of service could have been considered honorable. This comports with our understanding that a period of service ends when one is released, discharged, or resigns from service. Similarly, Smith v. Shinseki, 24 Vet App 40 from 2010, the court looked at 38 U.S.C. 1111, which provides that the presumption of soundness applies when a veteran is examined, accepted, and enrolled for service, unless exceptions apply. And even though the term period of service is not contained in the statute, the court found that it plainly requires an examination prior to entry into the period of service on which the claim is based, which also comports with our understanding that a period of service begins when one enters service.
So this is the Secretary's interpretation of what that term in the heading under H means, period of service.
Period of service in the heading, Your Honor, is not merely the Secretary's interpretation. Rather, it is a term of art consistently used by Congress, the court, and VA as well.
Okay, so let me give you a commissioned officer example. So what you're saying is a commissioned officer could serve for 30 years, and with the exception of the questioning that you went back and forth with Chief Judge Allen, that officer, that would be considered a single period of service. 30 years, the officer paid into the Montgomery GI Bill, met all the criteria, goes all the way through and retires, and that individual would only be eligible for one of the two programs between the Montgomery GI Bill and the post 9/11. That's the Secretary's position.
In the most general sense, Your Honor, yes. Of course, it would also depend on when that singular period of service began, and the yes would also be hinged upon there not being an exception that bars that officer's single period of service or qualifying for either Montgomery or post 9/11 based off of a service academy scholarship or an ROTC scholarship.
Okay, but those would be the exceptions. Are there more exceptions? Is it relevant for purposes of obligated service? Is that under the hypothetical that I gave you, 30 years, falling within the windows of both of those educational benefits?
And taking place, the period of service beginning on or after August 1st, 2011, Your Honor.
Okay. So the website guidance doesn't mention anything about specifically that would be relevant for purposes of commissioned officers. But would that require, for example, taking on additional obligated service? Is that?
Your Honor, there are certain educational benefits programs for officers that do require taking on additional service. I believe they include law school, medical school, and a psychology degree. I don't want to misspeak, but those are the three main where an officer could receive advanced education in exchange for an additional obligated period, an additional obligated time.
Rather. And that's what would be required in order to be eligible for both the benefits here?
No, Your Honor. That would be for different educational benefits. For Montgomery and post 9/11, officers just unfortunately have one lengthy period of service generally.
Well, they serve at the pleasure of the president, right? So, but there are periods where, because it's it could be some type of a bonus to continue because you've met your original obligated service, right? You go to medical school, you serve for the original obligated service. And is that would be a trigger that would make the difference?
No, Your Honor. My understanding is that continues on as one single period of service.
Okay, so you're saying if an officer comes on active duty at a particular time, serves 30 years, that is still just going to be, regardless of any additional obligated service, that's one period of service.
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And in terms of one of your answers to Judge Lauer was that for service on or after a date in 2011, right? You are getting that only from when it became effective, right? Because if you just read H1, there's no language there that you could point to. I mean, if you put a blinder on to when H1 was effective, given like when it was adopted, right? If you just read the language of H1, you can't point us to anything that says for service on or after a date.
Correct, Your Honor.
Wouldn't you think Congress, if that was such a critical distinction, would have put that actually in the statute?
Well, Your Honor, it seems more that because it is a bar, it doesn't get enforced against those who enlisted prior to the time that the bar took place.
Well, except it leaves open this question about what if you enlisted in 2008 and you had under the VA's view, a single period of service that partially occurred before and partially occurred after. If Congress really said, no, this is it's only this service after that would bar you, wouldn't they have said that, as opposed to the much more, it seems, simple point that says this is effective as of this date, which means if you apply for benefits after this date, this is the rule that's going to apply, regardless of when your service was done.
Well, Your Honor, 3322H1 looks at qualifying service in the armed forces that establishes eligibility. And when we're looking at qualifying service that establishes eligibility for Montgomery benefits, it's the obligated period of active duty that's crucial. And that obligation began before the effective date or before H1 became law.
And so the output of that would be if Ms. Perkins had started before, then your answer would be different, that she'd be able to, even without two periods of service, she would be able to get the benefit of what I'm calling the Rudisill rule, because nothing in H would apply.
Yes, Your Honor. If instead of entering service in August 2014, Ms. Perkins entered service in July of 2011, and had one period of service that lasted 6 years, then yes, she would in that instance be entitled to two separate, both Montgomery and post 9/11 benefit.
And so the idea of period of service only becomes relevant for you if the service is entirely done after that certain date in 2011.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if she had started on active duty one day before the effective date of H and served the same 6 years, she would be able to get both benefits. But because she started hypothetically one day later, she doesn't.
Yes, Your Honor, because her obligation began prior to H1.
We're writing a lot into H1 here, aren't we? I mean, in terms of the date, I mean, I'm not sure how one would be able to read H1 and know that that's the answer.
Well, Your Honor, I think it goes back to we don't enforce bars or limitations on those who entered into that obligation before that bar would have had what may be considered a negative impact on them. We wouldn't impose that restriction on those who agreed to that obligation before the restriction was put in place, and before Congress put that restriction in place specifically. And when we're looking at the qualifying period that establishes eligibility,
because Ms. Perkins has one single six-year period of service, that could qualify her for both, but it requires her to choose which program to benefit under, and she chose to credit her period of service to receive benefits under the post-9/11 GI Bill. And if the court has any lingering doubt as to the meaning of 3322H1, the Supreme Court addressed it in Rudisill when it explained that it has the best meaning. First, when it cited to H1 and noted that a later enacted provision further ensures that an individual may not receive double credit for a single period of service. Rather, he shall elect under which authority such service is to be credited. And then it began its summary of the statute by saying that per 3322, service members who are eligible for educational benefits under either the Montgomery GI Bill or the post-9/11 GI Bill from a period of service that could qualify for either program opt to credit that service towards one educational benefits program or the other. And second, the Supreme Court explained that 3322H bars duplication of eligibility based on a single event or period of service, and thus requires certain individuals to elect under which benefits program their services to be credited.
Except everything that the Supreme Court just said about 3322H would be utterly irrelevant under the Secretary's view of the statute, right? Because it didn't apply to Mr. Rudisill because all of his service occurred before that, right?
Well, yes, Your Honor, but the Supreme Court addressed 3322H in the context of understanding the rest of the statute.
Well, why? I mean, because if it didn't apply because his service was beforehand, why wouldn't that be the, you know, cut out the middleman? Why say anything about it at all if what the answer was is whatever 3322H1 might or might not mean, it has nothing to do with Mr. Rudisill, because even though he applied after it was effective, the key is when the service took place. I mean, wouldn't that have been a much more logical thing for the Supreme Court to say along the way?
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court was looking at how the bars themselves function and what sort of limitations are put on someone, because the question in Rudisill was how he could use those benefits based off of other bars within 3322. But
the Secretary's position is there is no scenario under the sun in which H could have applied to Mr. Rudisill.
Correct, Your Honor.
And yet, even that, the Supreme Court says all of these other things and doesn't say the thing about the service being all beforehand.
Correct, Your Honor, because the question of whether he was entitled to a second benefit wasn't at issue in Rudisill. Appellant, however, does fall within this bar, and Congress and this court and VA do not allow individuals to bifurcate a single period of service so that they can receive additional benefits. I see that I've exceeded my time, if I may conclude, Your Honor.
Yes. Do you have any questions, Judge Stone?
No.
Judge Lambert?
No, thank you.
So why don't you just take a couple minutes, a minute or so to wrap up.
Thank you, Your Honor. We therefore respectfully request that the court affirm the board's decision that found that 3322H1 barred appellant from using her single period of service to qualify for additional education assistance benefits under the Montgomery GI Bill.
Thank you, Ms. Dale. Ms. Miller, you have your rebuttal time.
Your Honors, the Supreme Court makes general, broad decisions that are meant to be able to apply to many different scenarios. The Supreme Court, with full awareness of situations like Ms. Perkins, said the following at Pennsite 306. Notably, our analysis does not focus on periods of service. Rather, what matters is that his lengthy service conferred two separate entitlements. Then, in discussing 3322, the Supreme Court expressly stated, regardless of 3322, quote, if service members serve for long enough, they may be entitled to both. My friend on the other side asks you to limit Rudisill to its facts, even though the Supreme Court went out of its way to ensure that future decisions could be guided by the Supreme Court's discussion of the full statutory scheme. In so doing, they rely on 3322H, but not even the text. If you notice, Your Honors, the VA and my friend on the other side does not engage with qualifying service or the actual language of the text. They hook onto a title, period of service, which is not defined, which has no sort of special import. Rather than look to the statutory text, they support that. They rely on the title. And notably, Your Honors, nothing in 3322H1, as you've pointed out, asks this court to treat individuals differently based on their service after 2011. And in fact, the VA is not consistently doing that, as this court has a different case before it, of the writ petition, and that individual was an officer who served, his period of service began before 2011, and he is being denied benefits for having a single period of service after 24 years. Nothing in the statutory text supports that, and nothing in the statutory text or any of the entitlement statutes supports treating officers differently than enlisted individuals. Yet the VA admits that it would. The VA admits that their interpretation treats both individuals differently. At bottom, Your Honors, this is just another attempt by the VA to contradict Congress's, this court's, and the Supreme Court's clear language. After this court correctly decided BOV Wilkie, the VA asked for the court to stay its precedential effect of that decision. When the court rejected that attempt, the VA nonetheless sat on Ms. Perkins' decision for 4 years with no explanation, finally coming to a decision after Perkins and going out of its way to ensure that Perkins, or after Rudisill, and going out of its way to distinguish Rudisill and not allow it to apply to Ms. Perkins. We ask this court to put a stop to this and to allow Ms. Perkins to receive her benefits before she runs out of time to use them. We ask this court to reverse the board's decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we formally close today, I understand that this will be the last time for the foreseeable future that Ms. Fusina will be appearing before the court, who's going to be leaving the agency very soon, I understand. And it's been my pleasure to have Ms. Fusina appear before the court several times since I've been a judge. And so we want to wish you well and say hi to the kids. So with that, we'll come down and greet counsel, and the case is submitted.
All rise.